of my friends left, they all vanished in the stream. I ain't got none of my friends left, they all vanished.
Instead of agonizing over the state of our nation, we organized in an unprecedented way in a 90-day sprint.
California voters overwhelmingly approve a measure to give Democrats more congressional seats.
For Wednesday, November 5th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. NPR reporting finds a pattern in the backgrounds of immigration judges fired by the Trump administration.
No one has told me why I was let go. You know, so this is all speculative. It has to be, because no one has had that conversation with me.
Also, more students are showing up to class, but attendance is still down compared to before the pandemic.
Because what the data is telling us is students of color, students with disabilities, and students from low-income backgrounds are most chronically absent.
And the Supreme Court seems skeptical of President Trump's authority to impose tariffs without Congress.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. New York City Mayor-elect Zoran Mamdani has announced his transition team as he prepares to take office at the beginning of the year. NPR's Sarah Ventry reports members of the team have served in past New York City mayor administrations.
The five-person team is made up entirely of women and includes a former Federal Trade Commission chair, former first deputy mayor, and the president and CEO of United Way of New York City. The team will be responsible for setting the stage for the new administration to enact an ambitious agenda. Mamdani, a Democratic socialist, campaigned heavily on promises to freeze the rent, make buses free, and create universal child care. In his acceptance speech on Tuesday night, he also promised to hire thousands more teachers, cut waste from a bloated bureaucracy, and work tirelessly to improve public housing. Sarah Ventry, NPR News, New York.
Democrats won big beyond the high-profile contests in New York, New Jersey, and Virginia yesterday. NPR's Stephen Fowler has more on the results from other state and local elections across the country.
In Georgia, Democrats flipped two seats on the Public Service Commission with more than 60% of the vote. The first time Democrats have won a non-federal statewide election there since 2006. In Pennsylvania, voters chose to retain three Democratic state Supreme Court justices and regained control of top offices in multiple swing counties. Mississippi Democrats broke a supermajority in that state Senate, while Democrats won enough seats to gain a supermajority in New Jersey State Assembly, and more than a dozen seats flipped in Virginia's House of Delegates. Stephen Fowler, NPR News.
Emergency workers are searching for more victims after the fiery crash of a UPS cargo plane in Louisville, Kentucky yesterday. NPR's Joel Rose reports at least 11 people died and more than a dozen were injured when the plane crashed while taking off.
Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear says first responders are still combing through the crash site in a mostly industrial neighborhood next to the airport in Louisville.
We've got to continue to search that site, hope and pray for the best, but know there may be more loss of life that we're going to learn about today.
The McDonnell Douglas MD-11 cargo plane was bound for Honolulu with about 38,000 gallons of jet fuel on board. Video footage of the crash appeared to show the plane's left engine on fire as it struggled to lift off from the runway before it crashed and exploded in a massive fireball. The National Transportation Safety Board is leading the investigation. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
A federal judge presiding over the Trump administration's criminal case against former FBI Director James Comey is ordering the Justice Department to produce materials from the investigation. The judge says he's concerned the administration's position had been to, quote, indict first and investigate second. Comey is charged with lying to Congress. Stocks gained ground on Wall Street today after upbeat economic updates. The S&P 500 rose 0.4%. This is NPR News from Washington. Starbucks union members have voted to strike next week unless the company finalizes a contract agreement. The strike would begin on November 13th, the day Starbucks plans to distribute free reusable red cups, one of the company's busiest days of the year. Every day, more than 3,000 people die from tuberculosis, making it the world's top infectious disease killer. Many people with TB live in low-income communities where health care is difficult to access. But now, AI is helping where medical specialists aren't available. NPR's Gabriella Emanuel reports.
In more than 80 countries, mobile X-ray machines are being combined with AI models to instantly screen people for TB. It's being used for nomadic tribes in Nigeria and refugee camps in Chad. Peter Sands heads the Global Fund.
There are no radiologists. So who gets to look at the thing and say, is there a problem here or not? Well, actually, AI does. It's brilliant.
Advocacy groups like Stop TB have embraced this approach, but some health experts have cautioned that many low-income countries don't yet have the regulations to make sure the technology has quality control checks. Gabriella Emanuel, NPR News.
Japan is deploying troops to help contain a surge of bear attacks in the northern Akita Prefecture. Bears have been seen near schools, train stations, and homes. Over 100 people have been injured and at least 12 killed in bear attacks since April. Experts say Japan's declining rural population contributes to the problem as bears venture closer to residential areas in search of food. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Total Wine & More for gatherings and fall nights. Curbside pickup and delivery available in most areas. More at TotalWine.com. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Available to adults 21 or older.
It's 4:06. Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing mental health care in Minnesota. November is National Adoption Awareness Month, highlighting the need for adoptive and foster care families. North Homes provides licensing and case management for those opening their heart and home. More information at northhomes.org. Increasing clouds tonight, lows 23 to 29.
Considered from NPR News, I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. And voters here in California have approved Prop 50. The measure allows this state to redraw its congressional map. The new map could mean as many as 5 new seats for Democrats after next year's midterm elections. Governor Gavin Newsom says the measure is a direct response to gerrymandering efforts in Republican-led states like Texas. But critics, like Republican Kevin Kiley of California, strongly oppose Prop 50. Congressman Kiley joins us now. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. Okay, so you have been very vocal about your opposition to Prop 50. Your seat is one of the seats targeted by this new map. But you have introduced a bill to ban all mid-decade redistricting nationwide, right? So let me make sure I'm clear. You oppose redistricting efforts by your own party as well, efforts that President Trump has pushed for?
That's correct. I don't care if it's a Republican state, a Democrat state. I think gerrymandering is wrong. So I opposed it in California. I opposed it in Texas. And ultimately, the passage of Prop 50, I think we should take as a call to action to get rid of gerrymandering nationwide and establish independent redistricting across the country.
And you think gerrymandering should end altogether or just mid-decade gerrymandering?
Well, so the bill that I've introduced seeks to sort of address this new phenomenon of mid-decade redistricting, which I think is especially pernicious. But ultimately, by the time of the next census and we're actually supposed to do regular redistricting, I'd like to see a solution for gerrymandering across the country as well.
But there was a bill put forward back in 2021, right, that was led by Democrats, that it would have banned gerrymandering altogether, and no Republican senators voted for it. So how do you get more of your Republican colleagues on board with your position on gerrymandering?
You know, I think more people are recognizing the extent of the problem for no other reason than we're seeing lots of states that are now having, their district maps totally upended. I think the bill you're referring to had a lot of other things in it, but what I'd like to see and what I'm actually working on now is something that's specifically tailored at just setting up something like an independent commission like we had in California in all 50 states. And actually, a silver lining of Prop 50 is that in addition to bringing back gerrymandering in California, what it also did was adopt a state policy in California of supporting independent redistricting nationwide. So I certainly intend to act upon that call to action from the voters.
Okay. Well, for now, at least, Prop 50 is the political reality in this state, in California. So that means the path to your reelection will probably be a lot more difficult. How do you see, or do you even see, a viable path for your political survival?
I do see a viable path. I, of course, am not happy that my beautiful district, I think the most beautiful district in California, is now going to be chopped into 6 different pieces. But, you know, kind of the fundamental flaw with gerrymandering is that it presupposes that politicians can dictate election outcomes simply by moving lines around on the map. But at the end of the day, the power still rests with voters to choose their representatives. And I think people, you know, they look beyond the party label, they look at the person. And I was fortunate in my last reelection to actually get the second most crossover votes in any of any competitive race in the country, meaning that people that voted for Kamala Harris for president but voted for me for representative. And that's because I focused on issues that don't have a particularly partisan valence, but are simply about improving the quality of life for the folks that I represent.
I want to turn now briefly to the government shutdown. You have also criticized your own party for keeping the House out of session during the shutdown. You've pointed to partisanship being one of the things preventing the reopening of the government. So let me just ask you, how do you suggest all of you end this game of chicken that we've been seeing for so many days right now?
Yeah, so having the House in session would be a start. I think it's totally unacceptable that the Republican leadership has decided to cancel sessions of the U.S. House of Representatives for six straight weeks. It's meant that all of our ordinary business has been shut down, in addition to meaning that we don't have a lot of relevance on the House side in getting us out of this mess. We are starting to see some encouraging signs of life. I've been having discussions with people on both sides of the aisle about addressing this health care issue of the cliff for these subsidies that will make healthcare a lot more expensive for a lot of people. My colleague in California from across the aisle, Sam Liccardo, and I have just released a framework on that issue. So I think that these sort of conversations on the Senate side as well are starting to lead somewhere. But it is just so unacceptable that we have had a government shutdown for 36 days now. And I think that these two episodes, the redistricting war and the government shutdown, really underline the extent to which excessive partisanship is one of the biggest challenges facing the country. That's what I pledged to overcome when I first ran. And I think that's more important than ever now.
Well, speaking of partisanship, when you look at the big wins that Democrats did have last night, undeniably, how concerned are you that that result might reflect that President Trump and his policies are just not all that popular right now?
Well, you know, everyone's going to attach whatever meaning they will to election results on a given night.
What do you attach to it?
I think that from my perspective in California, it's that the country is very divided right now. And people are just very frustrated with Congress in general, with Washington in general. I saw a poll showing that Congress has a 13% approval rating. Mm-hmm. And honestly, with this government shutdown, a lot of people have almost just become desensitized to the dysfunction of Washington. And even, you know, now there's just such an extreme example of it, people losing their food assistance and being furloughed for weeks on end, going without paychecks.
That is California Republican Kevin Kiley. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
The Trump administration is firing scores of immigration judges and bringing on dozens of others. These judges inside the executive branch are often immigrants' last chance to argue why they should stay in the U.S. NPR's Jimena Bustillo and Anusha Mather have found a pattern in the backgrounds of 70 judges who have been fired. The largest share have experience representing immigrants.
The story told is often the same. It started out as a dream job.
It was something that I was essentially born to do.
Tanya Niemer was selected to be an immigration judge in Cleveland.
I feel like as the middle child, I was always kind of just put in that situation between siblings and parents and cousins. And I always just loved listening and asking questions and understanding their perspective. And then if I had a basis to solve the problem, I loved to do that.
That's why she loved her job as an immigration judge. But that dream came to an end one day in February while she was in the middle of a hearing.
I had about, 30 or 40 immigrants in my courtroom. I had DHS. I had court staff. I was on the bench, on the record. I had just finished explaining all to the group, their rights and responsibilities.
Then her supervisor took her aside, and Niemer was informed that she was terminated, but not given a reason. She was escorted out of the building. Niemer was among the very first immigration judges to be terminated. Immigration judges are civil servants in the Justice Department, one of the agencies that has seen restructuring in the federal workforce. And since, that scene has played out in courtrooms across the country.
I think being a judge is sort of a goal, a career goal that a lot of immigration attorneys have.
That's Kira Lillian. She was an immigration judge in Northern California, and she got her email in the middle of an asylum hearing.
The interpreter who was in the courtroom with me, he had been in many hearings with me, and he just started crying, and he said, "I can't believe this is happening."
She was also never given a reason. Anand Petit was an immigration judge in Virginia, also fired during a hearing.
No one has told me why I was let go. So this is all speculative. it has to be because no one has had that conversation with me.
NPR has independently identified 70 judges fired by the Trump administration. An analysis of their professional backgrounds show that those who have prior background in immigrant defense make up the largest share of those fired. Out of those onboarded in the last 2 years, those who have some experience working for the Department of Homeland Security make up the largest share of those still on the bench. Dozens have confirmed to NPR that they were not given a reason for their firings. Several judges have wondered if their own experience defending immigrants was a reason. Here's Lillian, the judge in California.
Anyone who ever represented a non-citizen at any point in their lives, whether they also worked for DHS, whether they worked for ICE, that seems to be the indelible stain that got them fired.
The Justice Department said it doesn't, quote, target or prioritize immigration judges for any personnel decisions based on judges' prior experience. There are outliers to the rule. NPR identified judges terminated that had no immigration defense experience and were instead DOJ and DHS veterans. Similarly, the administration did keep some judges who had defended immigrants. Still, the large number of firings has long raised questions among judges like Petit over how this benefits the Trump administration's goal of mass deportations.
I know it's not agency needs because they're hiring other immigration judges.
Petit, the judge in Virginia, is referring to 11 new permanent judges. They have prior experience in immigration enforcement, the military, and federal service. They don't seem to have prior immigration defense experience. In the announcement, DOJ said that the new judges are, quote, joining an immigration judge corps that is committed to upholding the rule of law and that integrity is being restored to the agency. Dana Lee Marks was an immigration judge for 35 years and retired in 2021. She says having the courts and enforcement under the same branch of government means the courts are never fully independent.
What's happening now is that because the immigration courts are in an executive branch agency, which does have rightfully policy considerations, it skews the role of the immigration court system.
Marks and other former judges ultimately say the reshaping of the immigration court workforce impacts the limited due process immigrants get. The rapid firings, they say, changes the perception of how fair these courts will be as the administration aims to increase the number of people going through the system. Ximena Bustillo, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thanks for listening to People Powered KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. It's 4:18. Coming up in just a moment, our daily dose of phenology. John Latimer looks back at his nature notes for this date. Support comes from Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community, featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu at rapidsbrewingco.com. Here's John Latimer.
On today's date, November 5th in the year 2000, a shop worn Compton's tortoiseshell butterfly is flitting around near the entrance to my garage, no doubt looking for a place to spend the winter. This is one of five or so species of butterflies that overwinter as adults and will be among the first ones that we will see again in the spring. The butterfly needs a perfectly dry location. And as long as it's dry, temperature has very little to do with its survival. The butterfly has evolved to prevent frost from forming within the cell and has allowed the frost to form rather around the outside of the cell, which draws moisture from inside the cell through osmotic pressure. And this causes the interior of the cell to become even more concentrated with sugars, which makes it that much more difficult for that part of the body to freeze. And so the Comptons, the Mourning Cloak, the Milbert's tortoiseshell, and a bunch of species of comma butterflies all employ the same strategy. And looking for a place to hide in my garage is an excellent idea because it will be dry.
Star comes from this station. And from Chapter, offering Medicare advice to seniors nationwide this enrollment period and working to find the plans that best fit their needs. Advisors are available by dialing #250 and saying the keyword Medicare Help. And from Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. President Trump's claim of unilateral power to impose tariffs across the globe hit a wall of skepticism at the Supreme Court today. NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports that over the course of an argument that lasted more than 2.5 hours, both the court's conservatives and liberals seemed doubtful about the legal authority underpinning Trump's signature economic policy.
Solicitor General D. John Sauer, representing Trump, was first up to the lectern, telling the court that Trump imposed the tariffs to deal with two dire emergencies, a persistent trade imbalance and the flood of fentanyl entering the United States.
President Trump determined that our exploding trade deficits had brought us to the brink of an economic and national security catastrophe. These emergencies are country-killing and not sustainable, that they threaten the bedrock of our national and economic security, and that fixing them will make America a strong, financially viable, and respected country again.
But the justices were openly doubtful about the president's claim that he has this power under the International Economic Emergency Powers Act, known as IEEPA, a statute that, as Chief Justice Roberts observed, doesn't mention tariffs. Sauer replied that the statute's terms are, in his words, capacious, not restrictive. Roberts acknowledged that tariffs involve foreign affairs, but
the vehicle is imposition of taxes on Americans, and that has always been the core power of Congress.
Under your theory, said Justice Sotomayor, President Biden could have declared an emergency under global warming, and that would have been enough to justify his environmental policy. Justice Barrett chimed in.
Can you point to any other place in the code or any other time in history where that phrase, regulate importation, has been used to confer tariff-imposing authority?
When Sauer repeated the emergency situations that justify the Trump tariffs, Justice Kagan replied caustically,
it turns out we're in emergencies everything all the time, about like half the world.
Justice Gorsuch posed perhaps the most vociferous challenge to the Solicitor General.
You're saying there's inherent authority in foreign affairs, all foreign affairs, so regulate commerce, duties, and tariffs and war. It's inherent authority all the way down, you say. Fine. Congress decides tomorrow, well, we're tired of this legislating business. We're just going to hand it all off to the president. What would stop Congress from doing that?
I think what the court has said in its opinions is just that it applies with much less force, more limited application in this context.
Indeed, he said that Congress can always change the law and take back the power it ceded under the IEEPA statute. But Gorsuch wasn't buying the argument, noting that even if Congress passed a new law, the president could veto it, and it would take a 2/3 vote in both the House and the Senate to prevail. That, Gorsuch said, is a practical impossibility.
Congress is a practical matter. Can't get this power back once it's handed it over to the president. It's a one-way ratchet toward the gradual but continual accretion of power in the executive branch and away from the people's elected representatives.
Next up to the lectern was lawyer Neil Katyal, representing those challenging the Trump tariffs. He noted that IEEPA has been in existence for 50 years, and no other president has ever claimed that the statute grants him such unilateral power. Katyal got some tough questions from the justices, particularly about why the words in the law calling for the regulation of imports and licensing fees are not tariffs. But the hardest question came from Justice Barrett, and that was about how to return the money paid by businesses to comply with the Trump tariffs.
If you win, tell me how the reimbursement process would work. Would it be a complete mess? I mean, you're saying before the government promised reimbursement, and now you're saying, you know, oh, well, that's rich, but how would this work? It seems to me like it could be a mess.
Katyal said there would be a variety of options, prompting this from Barrett.
So a mess.
A decision could come more quickly than usual because both sides asked the court to expedite consideration of the case. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
Since schools reopened after COVID-19 first shuttered their doors, they have struggled to keep students showing up to class. As NPR's Caden Mills explains, the rates of chronic absenteeism skyrocketed with the pandemic. But a new study shows that those numbers are slowly coming down.
During the pandemic, nearly 30% of students were chronically absent. But recently, that number has come down.
The national chronic absenteeism rate right now is at about 23%.
Carl Felton III is a policy analyst with EdTrust, a nonprofit that advocates for underrepresented students. He's citing an analysis by another organization, FutureEd.
That tells me that thousands of students have returned to schools, which means that states are putting in the work. It's just slow.
Those numbers helped inform a new study by Felton looking at state policies around school attendance. The report highlights several states like California, Maryland, and Connecticut that have taken steps to address some of the root causes of chronic absenteeism. Felton says he hopes more states will implement policies targeted towards students most at risk.
Because what the data is telling us is students of color, students with disabilities, and students from low-income backgrounds are most chronically absent.
Some of the most important policy changes cited in the report revolve around discipline, like no longer suspending students for dress code violations or disrespect. Felton says that's vital because it allows students to feel safe at school.
The right things are happening, and those are the things that we want to uplift.
He adds, conversations around attendance often focus on what's happening at home, but chronic absenteeism can also be a reflection of the school environment. He says investments in after-school programs and family engagement, like at-home visits, have shown real results.
When we focus on reducing exclusionary practices and focus on relationships, students know that they can trust the adults in the building and school is a place that they want to be.
One challenge to combating chronic absenteeism is data. Felton studied 22 states and Washington, D.C., and found only about half have both clearly defined attendance standards and require teachers to take daily attendance. Without those clear expectations, it can be hard to keep everyone accountable, students, families, and teachers. Caden Mills, NPR News.
Nearly one in three construction workers in the U.S. were not born in the U.S. So how is the construction industry being affected by the Trump administration's aggressive immigration enforcement? We hear from people in the business of building on tomorrow's All Things Considered. If you aren't by the radio, try asking your smart speaker to play NPR or your station by name. This is NPR News.
It is 4:29. You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up in just a moment, national native news. And 1 hour from now, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. You can also find local election results at our website, kaxe.org. Support comes from Sanford Health with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. And we thank ICTV. ICTV connects, informs, and empowers the community through diverse media. Learn more at watchictv.org. Weather for tonight, increasing clouds, lows 23 to 29. Cloudy tomorrow, highs 42 to 49. Southeast winds up to 20 miles per hour. Lows tomorrow night, low 30s with a chance of mixed precip. And looking ahead to Friday, chance of sprinkles or flurries, cloudy, highs 34 to 41.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. President Trump wants the Defense Department to resume nuclear weapons testing immediately. As KJZZ's Gabriel Piatrazio reports, that's sending shockwaves around the West.
Prior to a moratorium imposed by Congress in 1992, the U.S. conducted over 1,000 nuclear tests, mostly done at the Nevada test site, even hundreds of above-ground detonations.
We can't fully rule it out. That would be extremely provocative.
Daryl Kimball is executive director of the Nonpartisan Arms Control Association.
I don't think people need to fear mushroom clouds on the desert floor outside of Las Vegas, but the very notion of resuming nuclear testing, in my view, is a disrespectful slap in the face to those who in the past have suffered from radiation poisoning from nuclear testing fallouts in the Mountain West.
Like Leslie Begay, a former Navajo uranium miner. He's also a Vietnam vet and cancer survivor, having a double lung transplant with 123 stitches in all.
That was the hardest thing I ever encountered. These are some of the things that people are going to go through.
Compensation for radiation exposure victims was revived this summer. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Piatrazio.
Residents of St. Lawrence Island in the Bering Sea have traditionally subsisted on walrus, whales, and fish. But availability of marine resources has been changing, and reindeer have become a staple. Now, Savunga is almost done building a meat processing facility that can turn it into a business. Ayolna Niden with the Alaska Desk has more.
Richmond Tooley rides his four-wheeler across the wet tundra outside of Savunga. The mountains of black volcanic rock glisten behind him in the September sun, and the Bering Sea in front. Tooley is a third-generation chief reindeer herder. He pauses to spot the animals through his binoculars.
All summer, there are reindeer out here.
St. Lawrence Island sits 100 miles west from mainland Alaska, with two villages on it, Savunga and Gamble. It's also home to several thousand free-range reindeer. In the late 1800s, famine struck the island, and the animals were introduced here as a food source. Today, the herd continues to support the island as warming conditions disrupt subsistence, and storms can hold up food deliveries for weeks. Now, Savunga is building a reindeer meat processing facility. Freeman Kinnicook is the business director of the Savunga Reindeer Commercial Company, a subsidiary of the village that will manage the facility. He says the plan is to slaughter reindeer about four times a year and sell it locally. In the future, there might be a chance to distribute it to other Alaska villages as well.
When we did those trial runs, we would sell on Facebook, and we couldn't keep up with the demand. It's undecided who the market is, but I know there's a market for it.
Perry Idiganakpangoi is a subsistence hunter and one of the locals working on a project. Pangovi says the new facility already brought a much-needed influx of jobs to the village and might open new economic opportunities.
It would be nice to have our stores selling our local reindeer because it's hard to afford that steak. It's like $50, $60 for a piece of steak. And to me, reindeer tastes a lot better than steak.
Construction is scheduled to be completed in the coming weeks. With reporting from Savunga, I am Alona Naiden.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Skugtash. For more than 40 years, Ramona Farms has revived ancient traditional foods. Tepary beans, pinoli, polentas, and more, all from store.ramonafarms.com. Ramona Farms supports this show. Om Nye.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs Strauss Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for over 40 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From BritBox, committed to helping viewers to see it differently with British TV, with new original series like Code of Silence, about a deaf woman recruited as a lip reader in a high-stakes police investigation. Streaming at BritBox.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. The National Transportation Safety Board is on the scene of yesterday's UPS cargo plane crash in Louisville, Kentucky. Officials say at least 11 people died, and that number is expected to rise. The MD-11 crashed into an industrial area at high speed as it tried to take off from the Louisville airport on a flight to Honolulu. We're joined now by reporter Justin Hicks of Louisville Public Media. Hi, Justin.
Hi.
So what exactly happened yesterday in this crash?
Yeah, so this aircraft, which was, again, a wide-body MD-11 cargo jet, it was roaring down the runway at the Louisville airport with 38,000 gallons of fuel just a little bit past 5 p.m., and then something happened to the left engine. Videos show fire and smoke with the plane struggling to get airborne, and then the engine detached from the wing and ended up next to the runway. And this particular jet had three engines, which should be more than enough power to counteract the loss of that one engine. Mm-hmm. Multiplane engines are designed to be able to take off when one engine quits working. So we know that something very critical happened. The plane exploded over several businesses, including one that recycles petroleum. And so that caused additional explosions throughout the night as firefighters tried to battle the flames.
Frightening. Well, what new information did investigators reveal today?
Yeah, so the National Transportation Safety Board sent Todd Inman to Louisville, and he says investigators recovered both of these black boxes, the cockpit voice recorder and the flight data recorder. And Inman said the plane did get airborne just briefly and cleared the perimeter fence before crashing into those buildings. He says the debris field now stretches for about half a mile.
Half a mile is a pretty large distance, but we have to be very cautious. The main thing we're also worried about are the safety of not only the investigators, but the first responders that are there.
So Inman says the NTSB will have 28 people here in Louisville, and it's going to be a complex and difficult investigation. They'll review the plane, the engines, maintenance records, pilots, everything you can think of. And when he was asked whether the government shutdown might have played a role, Inman did say that the Louisville Air Traffic Control Tower was properly staffed at the time of the crash.
Okay. Well, that was good to hear. Well, I understand that you were near the crash site today and spoke to some of the people who work around the area. What did you hear from them?
So this morning, I went to the police barricade, spoke with people who had businesses. A lot of them were truckers who had rigs parked down that street. Again, this is a kind of a cargo area. Mm-hmm. They all wanted to check on their property, but police have not let them through yet. One officer was telling people it may be a few days before they're allowed back there. And it was there that I met a fella named Shabit Alif. He says he opened a truck repair shop about a month ago. And he was there when the plane crashed. He said he had to wave down cops who were rushing to that fire to help cut open a fence and help him and his coworkers get out safely.
It was like really loud, this explosion and flames all over. Heat was so bad, you can feel it from distance.
Mm. Well, Justin, as you're talking to people in Louisville, what are they telling you about how they're feeling right now?
Yeah, so everyone's just in shock right now. You know, sort of a joke about Louisville is that this is a city that's made up of neighborhoods, which is really just to say that this is a tight-knit community, tight-knit city. Mm-hmm. And it's really fortunate this plane did not crash in an area full of houses. But, of course, UPS is the largest employer in Louisville.
Right.
So everyone here is affected in some way. just about everybody knows somebody who works there or has to drive near this crash site. Okay. It's just really difficult right now, and you can see how tough this is on people.
That is Justin Hicks of Louisville Public Media. Thank you.
Thank you.
Zoran Mamdani's supporters are celebrating his history-making win as the next mayor of New York City. Many say they believe he can make the city more affordable and fair, but they also hope Mamdani's progressive policy ideas and the upbeat tone of his campaign will shape American politics beyond New York City. NPR's Brian Mann reports.
When Mamdani took the stage at his victory celebration in Brooklyn, he flashed his trademark grin, then quoted American socialist Eugene Debs. Mamdani, himself a democratic socialist, hadn't just won. In unofficial returns, he topped 50% in a three-way race, beating Republican Curtis Sliwa and independent Andrew Cuomo, once a democratic titan in New York politics.
My friends, we have toppled a political dynasty.
Mamdani will take the helm of America's biggest city, having made big promises: free bus service, free early childcare, more affordable groceries, and frozen rents on some apartments. But on the night of his victory, many Mamdani supporters said it was the tone of the campaign, not the details, that moved them. Amir Al is 27, a Palestinian American.
I feel like there has been this darkness that's been, like, casted over New York City the last few years, and I'm really thrilled to see someone like a breath of fresh air like Zohran.
Mamdani will be New York City's first Muslim mayor, and his criticism of Israel over the war in Gaza and his support for Palestinian rights became major flashpoints in this campaign. More than 1,000 American rabbis signed a letter critical of his positions. A voter poll by the Associated Press on Tuesday found only about a third of the city's Jewish residents voted for Mamdani. But Ira Mont, who's 63 and describes himself as a Jewish Brooklynite, said he decided Mamdani was the hopeful choice.
Zohran is stepping into a very big show, but he is very clearly going to surround himself with the right people. He intends to be the mayor for everyone who lives here.
Mamdani's main rival in this election, Andrew Cuomo, who's 67, ran as an independent after losing the Democratic primary. He positioned himself as the pro-business, law and order candidate, arguing Mamdani would heighten anti-Semitism and make New Yorkers less safe. In his concession speech, Cuomo stuck to that ominous narrative.
We are heading down a dangerous, dangerous road.
But many voters here said they were turned off by the dark tone of Cuomo's campaign and by the sexual harassment scandal involving more than a dozen women that forced Cuomo to resign as governor in 2021. Bertha Lewis, who's 74 and African American, said she also just wants new, younger leadership in the Democratic Party.
Now is another generation, and clinging to power, which is a drug, as we have found out, is not good.
In his victory speech, Mamdani described his election as proof that ambitious policy ideas and optimism can win elections.
In this moment of political darkness, New York will be the light.
Mamdani enters City Hall in January with no previous executive experience, and he has a huge lift ahead, delivering on his costly promises. He'll face deep distrust from many of the city's business leaders, deep concern among leaders in the largest Jewish community outside Israel, and even skepticism within the Democratic Party. New York Senator Chuck Schumer declined to say whether he voted for Mamdani or Cuomo. But Mamdani's biggest challenge may be President Trump, who has threatened to cut off federal aid to the city. Mamdani spoke directly to Trump last night.
Since I know you're watching, I have four words for you. Turn the volume up!
This moment of celebration and defiance will quickly give way to the gritty, complicated business of governing. Mamdani announced his transition team this morning, made up of experienced former city and federal officials, all of them women. Brian Mann, NPR News, Brooklyn, New York.
This is NPR News.
This is KAXC. Thanks for listening to All Things Considered this afternoon. It's 4:44. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, North Star Stories, produced by Ampers, stories from throughout Minnesota. Support comes from Boreal Brushworks Painting in Bemidji, providing full-service interior painting in residential locations throughout northern Minnesota, offering custom kitchen cabinet refinishing, as well as one-room or whole-house repainting. More information at borealbrushworkspainting.com. Increasing clouds tonight, lows 23 to 29. Cloudy tomorrow, highs 42 to 49 with gusty southeast winds. Itasca Waters continues their free Practical Water Wisdom webinar series this Thursday at noon. This month's topic is how invasive freshwater snail species can disrupt ecosystems. Register at itascawaters.org. Let us know what's happening in your community. Send an email, psa@kaxc.org.
You are listening to North Star Stories, Voices from Where We Live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
In today's stories, Greater Minnesota is getting a boost in housing and infrastructure. Then, a state Supreme Court decision regarding transgender athletes. And a major national trade show moves to the Twin Cities. I'm Gracie J. Well, 10 northern Minnesota communities are receiving hundreds of thousands of dollars in state grants for housing, infrastructure, and commercial rehabilitation projects, according to AMPR's member station KAXE. The funding comes from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. The Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development Commissioner says the grants will help strengthen local economies and improve the quality of life, ensuring Minnesotans have safe and healthy homes no matter where they live. Next, the Minnesota Supreme Court made a landmark decision supporting the rights of transgender athletes. Catherine DeSalle has more about the case and the reactions to the ruling.
The decision was unanimous. It was historic.
That's Minnesota Senator Erin May Quaid, who also serves as an advisor at Gender Justice, a legal and policy nonprofit advocating for gender equity. Senator Quaid is referring to a recent ruling from the Minnesota Supreme Court in the case of Cooper v. USA Powerlifting.
Gender Justice took this case back in 2019. We knew even then that there was a messaging campaign orchestrated by anti-LGBTQ hate groups to deny trans people basic rights.
In 2019, Minnesota athlete J.C. Cooper applied to join USA Powerlifting, a nonprofit organization that organizes competitions for athletes competing in powerlifting, a strength sport with the goal of lifting a maximum amount of weight. Jess Braverman is the legal director at Gender Justice and an attorney for J.C. Cooper.
J.C. Cooper got a membership card to compete in the female category. She's a woman, and everything was fine until it came time for her to sign up for some competitions.
It was then that USA Powerlifting found out JC was trans and would not let her compete.
They said, we do not allow transgender athletes to compete in any women's events. They had a policy of banning transgender women from women's events.
JC went to Gender Justice for help. What followed was a four-year legal battle that went to the Minnesota Supreme Court.
We brought a lawsuit under the Minnesota Human Rights Act suing USA Powerlifting for discriminating against JC based on the fact that she's transgender.
The Minnesota Human Rights Act prohibits discrimination in employment, housing, education, and public accommodations based on race, religion, disability, sex, sexual orientation, and gender identity.
This case was really not motivated by any type of discriminatory motive based on Ms. Cooper's gender identity.
In their defense, USA Powerlifting's attorney, Ancis Visknins, presented scientific studies to the claim that athletes assigned male at birth maintain a performance advantage over athletes assigned female at birth.
It had everything to do with the fact that she's bigger and stronger than most of the women who want to compete in the women's division.
Last month, the Minnesota Supreme Court ruled in favor of J.C. Cooper, saying that USA Powerlifting discriminated against her. USA Powerlifting will now have to change their policy, or they cannot operate in Minnesota. Gender Justice and supporters of J.C. say they hope Minnesota can be a role model for other states in the inclusion, celebration, and protection of transgender athletes. For North Star Stories, I'm Catherine DeSalle.
You are listening to North Star Stories. North America's largest outdoor industry gathering, the Outdoor Retailer Show, is moving to Minneapolis in August of next year. The event will feature new collaborations, innovation showcases, and sustainability discussions through a leadership village led by athletes and industry experts. Organizers say the move highlights Minnesota's $13.3 billion outdoor recreation economy and strong business community. Local leaders say hosting Outdoor Retailer will boost jobs, partnerships, and innovation across the outdoor industry.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. You may know author E. Lockhart from her best-selling novel, We Were Liars. It came out back in 2014, and the young adult novel became a bestseller. And the story about an affluent family who spent every summer on a fictional island off of Martha's Vineyard gripped new audiences through its Amazon Prime series adaptation, which got some big emotional reactions from fans online.
Oh, it's a dog!
And this ending was insane. Jaw dropped on the floor.
This is devastating. I'm heartbroken.
Oh my God.
Oh my God.
I can't breathe it. I have full body chills.
Those were videos from TikTok users Tyler Conroy, at Emma0612, at Hallie Likes to Read, and at Addie on Addie. Now Lockhart is back with a new novel. It's called We Fell Apart. It traces the story of a young woman named Matilda. She receives a message from the father she's never met.
And she flies across the country and she gets to this kind of incredible property on the island of Martha's Vineyard. And her father is not there. Instead, living in this castle, basically, is a stepmother she never knew she had, a half-brother she never knew she had, who's her same age, and two other teenage boys who are living there for various reasons. And she kind of gets sucked into the world of life in this castle, which is a kind of an alternative life with a lot of big freedoms and big rules.
We Fell Apart is set in the same world as the original We Were Liars story, but Lockhart didn't always intend for that to be the case until she took a trip to Martha's Vineyard and came upon this massive castle-like property.
It was falling apart. It was exquisitely beautiful, and I felt like I had walked into a novel. And then I thought, oh, I've walked into a novel that I need to be writing.
I wanted to know what made E. Lockhart want to revisit this world for a third time.
I mean, honestly, if I could say to you the hold that Martha's Vineyard has on my imagination in a simple sentence, I wouldn't have needed to write three novels. You know, it's a beautiful coastline with a long history, right? There's also just this raging sea that is terrifying and full of sharks, right? Like the story of Plymouth Rock and the story of Jaws. Right? These are two of our big Massachusetts stories. Mm-hmm. And they both have a lot of space in kind of the American mind. So I think I'm interested in that, right? In the danger and in the iconography.
I wonder, what do you think it is about We Were Liars and the universe that you've constructed that has just resonated with so many people over the last decade?
Well, I don't really think it's the aspirational nature of it, although some people will argue that, right? Some people say, oh, we all want to watch rich people behaving badly. We all want to spend a summer on a fancy private island or on a fancy Martha's Vineyard estate. But I don't think that's what my most passionate readers are coming to my stories for. What they're doing that I can see, you know, anecdotally on TikTok and Instagram and in the comments on my social media is having a big reaction. They either hate this book or this TV show so much they want to throw it across the room and tell everybody not to read it, or they're breaking down in tears and saying, thank you so much. And also, will you pay for my therapy? You know, we can get so much entertainment from our phones and from those social media channels. But what we don't get is a big emotional investment, right? We can get laughter. We can get, you know, dopamine hits, can go on travel adventures, but we need a book or a longer form drama to give us an emotional catharsis. And people have a big reaction to these books, right? It's not always positive, but they have a big reaction.
These books all also seem to have these sort of big questions about morality at the center of them. What is it about grappling with that that continues to entice you? I'm thinking of this interview that I read with you from, I think, a couple years ago, where you talked about how your books, as well as the show, ask this question of, like, what do you do when you're ashamed of yourself? What do you do when you've done something horrible? And whether a person can find forgiveness for themselves?
Well, I am ongoing interested in that question, right? When you've done something you're ashamed of, do you sit under the rug? Do you, you know, get into that rug and pull everything out and look at it? Can you accept yourself? Can you tell yourself that you're going to change? You know, can you find a place of forgiveness, or do you carry that weight with you all the time? This is a fundamental question about just being a person, right? I mean, that's what fiction is about, whether it's my fiction or somebody else's fiction. It's about this problem of being a human being and figuring out a moral compass or a way to be in the world.
And I think what really strikes me about that is that across your books, we're talking about young people who are on that journey, who still have so much of their lives to live, who are trying to figure out all of those big, heady questions with not so many years of experience under their belts.
Well, I think one of the reasons I continue, you know, in middle age to be interested in writing about teenagers and for teenagers is that teenagers are in a really important and kind of exciting transition in life, right? They are separating from the institution that is their family of origin, that is their schooling, that is their church, that is their sports team, that is, you know, I could name any, you know, a whole lot of other things. Yeah. Their scout troop, right? There are these institutions that we participate in as young people. And when we're very young, they're just the water that we're swimming in. And as we become teenagers, we begin to question, rebel, renavigate our relationship to those institutions as we prepare to leave the nest or, you know, settle down in there. But we have to navigate that because we can suddenly see those institutions that shape us, and we're going to emerge into adulthood, you know, choosing our own identity and not just swimming in the water that we've always been in.
We've been speaking with E. Lockhart. Her new book, We Fell Apart, is out now. Thank you so much.
Oh, it was a pleasure.
All Things Considered is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Like a story you heard on this or another NPR program? Share it with a friend at npr.org. While there, you can also hear stories you missed, enjoy expanded content, or connect to your favorite member station, wherever you are. Get the NPR app for your mobile device. You can also lean back and enjoy NPR.org, optimized for the iPad. This is NPR.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from AT&T, a network that is making connections for Americans. Connecting changes everything. Learn more at att.com/YATT. From Drexel University, whose cooperative education program positions students to explore future careers before graduation. This is experiential education. More at drexel.edu. From Fidelity Investments, a dedicated advisor can help build a comprehensive wealth plan. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
It's a minute before 5 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We're people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. We invite you to join us at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Stay tuned for another hour of As It Happens, including the Up North Report, local news from our region at 5:30. 6 o'clock, As It Happens, news from a Canadian perspective. And 7 o'clock tonight, Ken McBride, your volunteer host for On the River, a great mix of music. Support comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care.